105.1.
The morning show with Jeffrey and Bill.
We'd have to have names.
Yeah. Bonzo Bill and Geriatric Jeffrey.
Hold on, let me drink my insure. Hold on. All right. Hey, sports fans. If you're here, you're in the wrong place. It's Tuesday, which means it's on Taking Pictures Day. It is episode 105, and we're here and we're going to talk about photography. We're going to talk about things related to photography. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com, where you will find all sorts of photographic and artsy and creative things. And with me, the post breakfast, pre lunch, Bill Wadman.
Yeah, I'm sort of halfway through lunch, actually.
Yeah. But,
hey, you know, the whole Tuesday being OTP, has that been an official proclamation from the president or anything like that?
I think so.
Can we work on that if we haven't?
You know, if it would just be something else he would say he's going to get around to doing.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. That's nice.
Right after he closes.
See, there's something Hattie can do for us. She can get us proclaimed Tuesdays right. On Taking Pictures Day.
Could you just talk to Obama about that, Hattie?
Thanks. Yes. Make that happen, at least in Texas.
Super thanks.
If not in America, at least in Texas.
That's right. Hey, before we get started,
yep.
I have a request.
Which is?
Listeners. I want you to, if you would.
Close your eyes.
That's right.
No. Picture the sunset.
That's right. You're going to your power cave. No. I'd like you to help us out. We want to get more people on board with this show. We want to get more people into the fold. We want to keep growing. We want to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. So
we're not at capacity right now?
We're not at capacity.
Okay.
We are not at maximum density. So what I would like you to do is you all have some sort of social media stream, I assume, whether it's Twitter or G Plus or Facebook or just good old fashioned email. Would you tell a friend about us? Whether or not you think they're into photography, whether or not you think they know about us, would you just do us this solid and say, hey, check out an episode of OTP and give them your favorite episode?
Oh, good one. I like the little addition at the end there.
You know?
Yeah.
Like here's why I really dig this show. And maybe give them an episode, whether it's, you know, I don't know, episode 12 or episode 48 or episode 104. Who knows?
Yeah.
Let's see if we can really give us a jump here on listenership, because we do want to keep growing and keep coming to you every week. So if you would do that, we would appreciate it.
Yeah. Always fun to have more people, and then we could have even more people show up at the get-togethers.
Right. Which apparently was pretty fun.
Yeah, we had a good time yesterday. A dozen people or so showed up. They drank beer at McSorley's and they made me
wussed out and got a seltzer water.
Yeah. They had crackers and cheese and then a little hot mustard and then apparently a slice of raw onion on top. And that's the thing.
All right.
And Connors made me eat one, and I was just like, I don't know about this. And he, yeah, it was
all
right.
Did both Connors show up?
All three of them showed up.
Yeah. Wow.
They're multiplying. Like the plague. All three showed up. It was good. I met Millie from the group. It was good.
Right. Hey, okay. Now Millie was down from Montreal on vacation. She's going to be in town for like a week, right?
Yes. I think they're leaving at the end of the week, I think.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was nice meeting people from out of town, a couple of people from in town that I hadn't met before.
Right.
It was fun. It's every once in a while, it's fun to get together in real life.
And did you do the walk and talk afterwards?
We took a little walk and we chatted and took some pictures and that kind of stuff. And then mm-hmm. We had to break mm-hmm. off, but it was fun.
Did Freddie behave himself?
As far as I know, I needed to check everybody's pictures to make sure, see if anybody got anything on record. But it was good. But, you know, a bunch of the pictures are up in the Google Plus group that people took on there.
Excellent.
And speaking of Google Plus group, a lot of people took their stranger, hashtag stranger picture.
Right.
Which was last week, right?
Right.
And then do we have a new one for this week?
We have a new one for this week. We're going to continue this sort of stranger theme.
Stranger danger.
So hidden.
Okay.
Hidden. How do you interpret that? Hidden. Is it hidden emotion? Is it a place that's hidden? Is it what is it?
Okay. I like hidden.
Hidden.
I can finally go into my closet or come out of the closet. Wait, which one is it? Hidden. I can get on board with that one.
And there again, fantastic stuff posted up there. Couple updates. T-shirt update.
Okay.
No t-shirts.
People were asking about it. Quit
asking about it.
The update is that there will not be any t-shirts.
Quit asking about it. I'm tired of hearing about it. I've never really been on board with it. Let's just move on past that.
Wait, hold on a second. Why are you anti t-shirt?
It just doesn't seem like it fits. There's too much energy been put into it for the return. So you want to do one, fine, but you got to take me out of the loop because I'm tired of thinking about it.
Okay. All right. And then what's the other one?
Book update on the book. I have received a couple samples from a company called Ingram. And I'm going to photograph those samples and put them up hopefully today.
How good do they look?
We're not talking about, you know, Stiedel quality.
Okay.
This is the best direct print quality I've seen.
Okay.
Is it $200 art photo book quality? No. Is it $50 book quality? Sure.
Okay.
But I would like to put it out to you guys in the group and see what you think. So I will take some photos of some of the pages in the book and try and get it from different angles because it's not really a gloss surface, nor is it a totally a matte surface.
So it's like almost like thick magazine?
Sort of, but it's not a glossy stock.
Okay.
There was talk that they were moving or adding to rather a glossy stock to their.
Is it sort of a waxy stock? Does that make sense?
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah. Similar. It's not a. It's like a 70-pound paper that they're using.
Okay.
I think it looks good, but I like more of a matte finish. So I want to give you guys as much information as I can and see what you think before kind of moving ahead with it. Cause I don't want to, you know, get this thing underway and then find out people, I don't really like that.
Sounds like the paper that I used at Blurb on my 365 portraits book, which worked out fine. So
maybe it's not a gloss. So we'll see. I'll put some stuff up and, you know, please leave a comment or something and let me know what you think and we'll see how this can move forward.
Okay.
Fair?
Yep.
All right.
What's next?
Are we done? Are we moving on? You don't have anything else to say about the meetup?
For the book update? For the meetup? No, I mean, you know, it was fun for everyone who's there. I don't want to bore people who weren't
there. A splendid time was guaranteed for all.
You know, I thought Bellward was going to show up, but he didn't.
His van broke down.
Yeah. So, it was a good time.
All right.
Nice seeing people in person. Now, while I was doing that, you were at Paris Photo.
Over the weekend, yeah. I went to Paris Photo, which is mind-numbing in how much really fantastic work is there. I would like to thank Liza at Fitz & Company for the hookup on media passes. Thank you very much, Liza. I really appreciate it. This thing takes over the entire New York back lot at Paramount Pictures.
Okay, which is how big?
I don't know. It's pretty good size. A couple of football field maybe, football field and a half. I don't know, something like that.
Okay,
but then it also because it's kind of a dog leg shaped, and then it kind of goes into the sound stages where there were booths in the sound stages as well. So like the New York streets were sort of that's where each of the little stoops were galleries.
Okay.
And then there were additional galleries inside these sound stages, and then there was another soundstage kind of off to the side that had the LA crime scene photo exhibit in it called Unedited, which was fantastic.
Okay.
And then there was another soundstage that had screenings in it. And then there was an offsite thing that had this whole Dennis Hopper tribute / retrospective.
Okay.
Which was fantastic. So, you know, really comprehensive. I mean, all the big guys are there and girls. You know, Avedon's represented, Elliot Erwitt. There was a really great black and white showing of William Eggleston.
Now, this is technically, this is for galleries to come show a bunch of stuff. Is that right. The
big thing is, yeah, it's galleries coming to say, here's who we have represented.
Okay, so this is similar to the show that I went to at this giant armory in New York last year. Okay, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So now you can go as a general public person to look around, partially that you may actually have money and want to buy something, but also just to look around and gawk.
Right.
Got it.
Right. Okay. Now, in addition to the galleries, a number of publishers are there. Taschen is there. Aperture's there. Sure. There are
Shilling
book signings.
Yeah,
there are book signings with different authors. Mitch Dobrowner did a signing. Danny Lyon did a signing of the Seventh Dog.
Okay.
And it's a really interesting environment because you've got, you know, like Thursday night was the press event, VIP kind of event. And you've got like Brad Pitt and Orlando Bloom and Jodie Foster and like all these people, you know, walking around buying stuff. And then the actual show runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And sort of peppered throughout the 3 days, you've got a variety of photographers. Stephen Shore did a speech and did a book signing. And you know, you've got all these people kind of wandering around. And what's funny is, and then you and I were talking about this yesterday, and you made a great point that a lot of the, like photographer, what did you say? Something like photographers are a lot like authors in that.
No one knows who they are.
There's a degree of anonymity.
Sure.
And went into one little gallery, the Melanie Rio Gallery, and saw this work that I think was probably my favorite work of the show. It was by a French photographer, a guy named Jean-Claude Pondivy, and it's this really sort of moody black and white. It looked almost like graphite. The richness of the print looked almost like graphite on paper. And had this really nice conversation with Melanie Rio, and I said, you know, it just really affected me. I would love to talk to the photographer. And she says, well, he's sitting right out on the stoop. And we had passed him going in.
Yeah. He's just some guy.
Just some guy, just sitting there by himself.
Yep.
And so I went out and introduced myself and said hello, and a little bit of a language barrier because, you know, he doesn't speak English very well, and I don't speak French at all.
Right.
Despite taking 2 years of it, I don't remember a thing. But, you know, there was enough of an exchange to say how much I liked his work and that kind of thing. But it's just funny because it got me thinking how many other photographers that were there that you may end up talking to or you may pass by and you have no idea who they are.
Sure. Yeah. But at the same time, how many photographers are out there who, even if you got to them talking, couldn't eloquently talk about their work anyway, in any way that would give you an addition to their work? There's a lot of them out there too.
Right.
You know, but I mean, look, you and I talk about, we have our photographer of the week every week, and now we've done, what, 105 or 104 of these people.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the people we talk about are classic people, but how many people walking down the street would know what Jay Mazel looks like, or Eggleston, or any of these guys?
Right.
You know? And even the ones you could recognize, let's say you said, I know who those people are. How many do you actually know? 10?
Right.
In the whole world? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Your works speaks for the work speaks for the person. And the person is, you know, even like I was watching that, what's it called? The Rankin thing. Now, I'd never seen Rankin moving and talking, and he was very different moving and talking than I ever imagined him actually being.
Yeah. When you see stills of him, you kind of form this opinion of what his personality is like. Yeah.
But he's actually kind of effeminate and weird and silly. And you know what I mean? Like nothing like you would imagine he would be just by seeing a single headshot of him on the back of a book.
Yep.
If absolutely. You had seen that headshot at all. Right.
It was kind of funny. When you get there, there are these little golf carts that take you from the media entrance to like the little, you know, VIP kind of red carpety area. And riding on the little cart, seated a couple benches in front of us, there was a photographer. I'm assuming he was carrying a camera. He had his hat on and everything. And I was like, I was thinking to myself, I'm like, I know who that is. And I said to Nick, I said, I think that's Renzi Ruiz.
Okay.
And we finally get to the little place and we get off the tram and I was like, Renzi? And he turns around. And I was like, no way. I said, you know, I introduced myself. And he's like, oh, hey, no, no way. How's it going? So it was kind of funny that right off the bat, here's somebody whose work I really love.
Right, right.
And had never met. In fact, only really found his work through Ibarian X.
Right.
So it was just kind of funny, you know. And he was there with his friend Dana, who was shooting. Renzi was shooting with the new Fuji, the X-T1.
Right.
And then his friend Dana was shooting with like an M6.
Now
it was just kind of funny.
You were looking around. Anything you wanted to buy while you were out there?
You know, I was much more. I mean, you know, like I said at the beginning, all the big guys and girls were there, the people that you would expect. Mm-hmm. But I found myself more affected to. Engaged by work that I'd never heard of before, people I'd never heard of before.
Well, that's you are also you get quickly. How do I say this? You get saturated by a new find.
I do. I take
you're
it
much
in.
More moved by something new. Somebody you know well. You get unimpressed by them quickly.
I'm not unimpressed. I just feel like, okay, you know, like even the Eggleston stuff, it's like, it's great. It's beautiful work. Right. But I feel like I've seen a lot of it.
Right. Okay. Right. You know? Because you've seen a lot of it, it loses its punch.
Right.
For you.
So when I see work by somebody.
You need a new hit. You need a new drug.
That's right. Catherine Cooper, fantastic photographer. Christina De Medel, another really, really great photographer who was kind enough to sit and talk about her work for a little bit and what
well,
kind
that's
of process.
Why they're there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's an approachability there that belies the price of the work.
Okay. You're saying that the print might be $3,000-$5,000, but then the person's just sitting out on the front stoop.
Yeah, there's an expectation there that there's not going to be that sort of approachability.
Right. But the people you're talking about are the, forgive me, lesser known people who were there. You weren't going up to Stephen Shore and sitting on a stoop and talking to him for an hour.
No, but there were people that were doing that.
Yeah.
And he seemed, you know, what I could glean just by watching him talk to people, he seemed very approachable as well.
Yeah. Well, my mother has no idea who Stephen Shore is. You know what I mean?
Right.
In fact, I think most photographers would have no idea who Stephen Shore is.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, well, it was just kind of the same thing last year with Gregory Crudson.
Sure. He was just
Once he was away from the theater that he was speaking in, you know, very few people recognized or came up to him and said hello. And, you know, he was just sort of walking through the show.
He's just some guy.
Right. Another thing that kind of struck me about the show was I put up a kind of a review / thoughts on Faded and Blurred. We'll put a link in the show notes, but I say it in the article, this isn't a reflection on Paris Photo, but more a reflection on where sort of art and photography is as a whole. And that is that it's not for the casual collector. It's not for the person who's just enamored with the work.
No.
Because you can't afford it. Even the people you've never heard of, you can't afford it.
Well, yeah. If they're there with a gallerist, they're going to be expensive anyway. Yeah.
So, I mean, I would love to have had one of Jean-Claude Pontivy's photographs. But, right. You know, they're $4,200. Right.
But here's the thing. How many were up on 20? The wall of his? 10?
12, I think, okay. Were up on this.
So
up on
4,200.
The wall. Wait, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. I think there were 12 right. or 15 or
now,
so.
This is probably one of the big chances he gets per year, his gallerist, to get in front of a ton of people.
Other than Paris Photo in Paris,
right,
sure.
Right, okay. So let's say just on crazy off chance he sells all 12 of those. Let's say 10 just to make the numbers easy.
Okay.
Let's say he tells 10 of those. That's $42,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the gallery takes half. That's $21,000. And then, what are the costs to print it? That's, you know what I mean?
It's probably $500 yeah. to right. print and frame
and then,
it.
And then minus the taxes, minus he's walking away with 10 grand, maybe.
Maybe.
Twice a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's funny how when you really break it down, it doesn't add up to all that much.
No, but from the end user perspective,
it's
my
still
$4,200.
No,
it's $4,200, and I'm not buying
agree.
It as a stock. I'm not buying it as an investment. I'm buying it because it brings me joy to look at it.
But art has become that. Well, but see, at that point, you could also, for example, instead of buying the Eggleston print, buy a really nice big book of Eggleston prints and cut one out and stick it in a frame on your wall.
Sure you can.
If what you're looking for is just the pleasure of looking at the picture.
But it's just saddens me that average people are relegated to buying books.
Yeah.
Because the prints are so expensive. And I've got some noodlings on how to address that. But
let me just play devil's advocate for a second here. There are, as we know, millions upon millions of photographers in the world, many mm-hmm. of which you've never heard of and are quote unquote nobodies in the business.
Most of
right?
which I've yep. heard of.
And you see stuff all the time on Flickr that you're like, wow, that's a great print picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where I bet you if you wrote the person who took that picture, 9 times out of 10, you could buy a print for $150.
If even that.
Right.
Maybe. Yeah.
But no one does, very few people do that.
Right.
So right. whose fault is it? You know what I mean?
Well, I don't.
So
I'm not
so
saying,
don't buy this guy. Buy
ascribe,
the guy like him who isn't at a gallery, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not trying to ascribe blame. All I'm saying is that when I go to these types of things, the inspiration and joy that I feel is offset by the fact that I can't afford any of the work. You know,
sure.
even like Christina De Midel's. She had this book called Party, and it was this little book by Mao Zedong, right?
Yeah.
That she sort of whites out certain passages.
Is it like
and then,
The Little Red Book?
Yeah, The Little Red Book, yeah.
Got it.
And then photograph, you know, there's a photograph that goes with the words that are left from what she has whited out, okay?
Sure.
And the book was I don't know, $50, $60, $70, something like that, $80, something like that. And it sold out on Friday. She had a couple that were going to be available on Saturday, but it's already on eBay for, you know, more than $300.
Right. How much were they at the place?
$80 or something, $75, something like that, 100 maybe. You know, so this thing is already tripled.
So you're saying it's a commerce thing and that upsets you?
It does upset me because, again, it prices itself out of the realm of many people who don't care that it's signed and numbered. They just fell in love with the image. They were just affected by the image, not the signature underneath it, not the number, not.
And do you think that was different at some point?
I think it's probably a little worse now because everybody's looking for the next big thing to invest in.
Okay.
You know, and there are a few people still doing it. You know, you just picked up one of Shepard Fairey's prints, a silk screen, right?
Yeah.
Signed, numbered screen print that's still, you know, what, $60, $65?
Yeah, $70, something like that, plus
okay.
shipping.
And the day of, you could go on eBay and probably find it for 2 to 3 times what you paid for it, if not more.
Yeah, you can. Yep.
And, you know, I know it's a reality. I get it. But it doesn't make me any less happy about it, just accepting that it's reality. It just, you know, I'm saddened by the fact that I can't put some of this stuff on the walls around me. But to your point, there are probably any number of people out there that I haven't seen yet that affect their work would affect me just as much.
Right.
And again, I've got some noodlings on that. I'm not really ready to share them yet, but I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking about a mechanism to address that.
It's a tough thing, because at the same time, you know, that guy who the example we gave, you know, if this is his chance to make 30 grand a year from selling his photographs, who, you know, like to take that away from him. You know what I mean?
I get it. Yeah, no, I definitely get it. And it's a toss up whether the economy of scales translates to art.
Well, I guess, you know, that's the funny thing. How much, excuse the term, crap do most people put on their, like, the average person does not buy art and stick it on their walls. They either have, like, family photos, which is fine, or they have some completely mass-produced, you know, like, basically the picture that came in the frame kind of stuff. You know, most of the people I know, like, my mother doesn't have, other than the stuff that I've given her, mm-hmm. doesn't buy art to put on her walls. You know, I think the average person doesn't. And maybe there's a value of art in society overall of something that should change or could change, or, you know.
Right.
It gets complicated. I don't know. I agree with you, though, that it's sad that you just can't. Yeah, that things are too expensive for the average person to buy. But at the same time, let's say instead of selling them for $4,200, he sold them for $42 and just made 100 of them. Would you be as interested if there were 100 of them out there versus 5?
Yes. I don't care how many.
I know you don't, but I think that you are the minority.
I probably am. Yeah. I just want the image. I just want the work.
So your question is the art for the fan or is the art for the collector?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's probably always been for the collector, and the collectors who could afford it could call themselves fans.
Maybe. Yeah. So, you know, it was interesting to see that. And again, the crime scene photos, that was a fantastic exhibit. More than a million photographs that they culled through from the 1920s to the 1960s.
Yeah.
And like there were two, like if you were to like sort of outstretch each arm, they had two photographs minus the torso of just the arms of Miles Davis. And you could see like all the track marks in his arms,
Yeah.
You know, cause he was arrested for, you know, heroin or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you know, suicides and, you know, it was just fascinating to see that side of the law, I guess.
Yeah.
Or that side of LA.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it was a lot of fun. I would recommend, like, if you're in LA or here next year or something, I would highly recommend it. It was a lot of fun.
I'll come out and we'll go next year.
It was, yeah, it's neat, you know. But now, by contrast, Patrick went to Photo Independent, which was across the street at Raleigh Studios, and said it was just sort of meh. And I heard that from a couple people who we ran into.
Now, what's a Photo Independent?
It was just another photo fair, but it just really hit and miss. You know, he said there were a couple good pieces there, but just kind of meh overall.
You know, I think part of the fun is probably the location of the Paramount one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, there is a part of that where you're. Yeah. You know, absolutely. The environment is.
Yeah, you feel like you're in an episode of, you know, Bones or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it was interesting talking to some of the gallery owners or you know,
I think they're referred to as gallerists.
Is it gallerists?
Yeah,
okay. Probably. Gallerists. it was interesting talking to some of them about the work and how they see the work and playing this sort of almost interview role of seeing really how much they knew about their people that they were representing.
How much did they know? A lot or a little?
It kind of varied.
Okay.
You know, in some cases, you really felt that the gallerist, thank you, believed in the work.
Right. And other times they felt like a high-end salesman.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, they're a car salesman in a better suit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. But some of them, they spent a half hour talking to me about the work and why it was, you know, why they found it moving and why they love the work. And that is more infectious to me than just simply telling me why it's important and why I should buy it.
They pressed all of your erogenous zones, didn't they?
Yes. Yes. So anyway, any day for me that I can spend being sort of immersed so deeply in work like that, whether it's photography or painting or sculpture, that's a good day for me.
Okay.
And I overall came away incredibly inspired by some of the things that I've seen there.
Yeah. Sometimes I go to those things and it excites me. And then other times I feel like it's the business world sucking on the teat of creative people. You know, and I know that's a,
there was some of that, sure, yeah. But I don't think you can avoid it.
No,
because it is a business.
Yeah. It is a mutually beneficial arrangement in many cases.
Yeah. And then there are people that are going there with the express purpose of, you know, this person's not going to be around much longer. I want to get in while I can before they go from 12,000 to 22,000.
Yeah. Yeah. I should have bought some of those yesterday. Yeah, imagine buying, like, okay, I bought this Shepard Fairey thing because we were talking about it a couple weeks ago or whatever.
Yes.
And I bought it. And I bought it because Conrad's really into Joe Strummer, right? And just is like on a lark, right?
Right.
And, you know, I spent whatever, $80, $90 with shipping or whatever it is. Like I'm fine spending $100 every once in a while on something like that.
Sure.
I couldn't spend $1,000 on it. You know what I mean? Easily. Right. Like easily.
Right.
And I guess that's just, it's just a scale, you know?
Well, and I have to, whether you like his work or not, I have to applaud Shepard for having sort of two distinct lines of work. You know, you can get the originals, you can get the original collage pieces, you can get the pieces on aluminum, you can get the pieces on bamboo, whatever,
right,
at, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a piece. But for those people who really like his work and want to have something by him,
you don't think it's just more people trying to buy and that's the most they could afford? You don't think that they're, most of the people who are buying like me, you think they really like the work and they're not buying it because it's a Shepard Fairey and it might be worth something someday?
It's not going to be worth $10,000. It's a right. screen print.
Yeah, I know. But I'm just, you don't think, you
know,
that that's
my,
the case.
My entire, you know, collection, if you want to call it that, of his work isn't worth 10 grand.
Right.
And I don't care. That's not why I bought it. I bought it because the images, his style, the way he sees, his vision, whatever you want to call it, yeah, resonates with me.
Yeah. I just wonder if most people value that resonance in this as much as you and I do.
I hope so.
I think we're particular.
I really hope they do. Well, I hope people buy things for things like this, for the way it makes them feel. And maybe that's my own sort of naivete or it's just the way I want to see the world.
Yeah.
But it's important to have things around you that are beautiful or thought provoking or evocative or whatever. It's important.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
Even, you know, it doesn't have to be art. It could be music. It can be, you know, food. It can something that you allow yourself to be affected by.
Yeah.
Is important.
Yeah. What if you're affected by your own things?
I think that's great. I have a lot of my own stuff hanging.
It's interesting. I gotta mix up some of the stuff on my walls. I mean, we have some stuff from other people and we have some stuff of mine. But I think I gotta mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's what else we got? You put this Pressfield article in, which I read.
What did you think?
Well, give me the initial thing and then I'll tell you what I think.
Well, okay, the article is called "Can Writing Be Taught?" And we've talked several times about how much or how little can be taught or practiced.
Okay.
And this particular article talks about a guy who in some ways kind of parallels, you know, what probably a lot of listeners have done. They've been in a job that they didn't really like, or didn't really feed their soul. And at some point he decided to change it. Right.
Yep.
So he says, I didn't play piano for 10 years, a decade of slow death by greed, working in the city, chasing something that never existed in the first place. Parentheses, security, self-worth, Don Draper, albeit a few inches shorter and a few women fewer. And only when the pain of not doing it got greater than the imagined pain of doing it, which is a common thread among taking action. Right.
Yep.
Did I somehow find the balls to pursue what I really wanted and had been obsessed by since the age of 7, to be a concert pianist? Now,
that part ahead. Of the article I am fine with.
Mm-hmm.
The part of the article that I think he sounds like he's in a really bad mood while he was writing it is further down, where he says, that's why desire is everything, because only desire can make you go there. Shame won't work. Greed, lust, avarice, the pursuit of fame or money won't work. Suffering works. Grief works. Heartbreak works. Fear of death works. Hate works.
Okay.
So it feels like I love some of this, and then other parts of it, I was just like, wow, you just sound really cranky. And there, I know just as many artists who would say it's not about hate. In fact, it's entirely about love.
And for some people that works.
Yeah.
But for other people, I mean, look, some of the greatest songs ever written have come out of grief.
Yes, absolutely. But it's some of the greatest songs are also love songs.
Right. So but for him, you know, right. this is what works.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's for, I think it's, I was reading this and thinking that all of those things speak to vulnerability.
Yes.
All of those things speak to laying yourself bare.
Yeah,
where but, there is no skin over the nerve. Whether it's heartbreak or whether it's adoration or love or fear.
Do you think Pressfield is holding up this James Rhodes or the piano guy as like a beacon, as like, see, this is the way to do it right?
I think the way I read this article was. This process, this thought process of being on the opposite side of love and not championing, but talking about suffering and grief and fear.
This guy also seems like he's crazy. No income for 5 years, 6 hours a day of intense practice, monthly 4 day long lessons with brilliant psychopathic teacher in Verona, a hunger for something that was so necessary it cost me my marriage, 9 months in a mental hospital, most of my dignity, and 35 pounds of weight.
Yeah.
Like,
well, look, this is a very extreme case.
Yeah.
But I think that Pressfield, from what I get from this post and from reading some of his books, I feel like this guy's point of view, his state of mind, his sort of methodology is very in line with Pressfield's as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I've been listening a lot to, what's his name? Who's the other guy who does the, podcast interview show that I like?
Battery Next Perello.
No, not the photography guy. I was talking about, where the heck is the playlist? Playlist. What the hell's the guy's name? Kevin Pollak.
Oh, the Kevin Pollak chat show.
Right. So yeah. I've been listening to, I listened to like 5 or 6 of those in the last week. And most of them I thought were good. I'm really surprised about the lack of quality of recording that he has in a lot of them, though. I was just like, you have backers. You can't make this sound better. But the best one I think that I heard was Bobcat Goldthwait. Have you listened to that one?
No.
You should. It's good. And, you know, Bobcat, you know, was doing his crazy manic comedy thing in the 80s. He was in you know, Police Academy and all these other things. And
also
now,
in One Crazy Summer with John Cusack.
And now he makes independent films. He's made like half a dozen of them or whatever it is. And he's just like, look, I make these movies for next to nothing. He's just like, and I told my daughter, she's not getting any money from me because there's no money, right? He's like, I go and I do my one show at an Indian casino once a month or whatever it is, so that I can go do all this stuff on my own. But the one thing that I bring up about it is that, you know, he says, a guy once told me, like, if you're not creating, you're waiting. So you might as well just keep creating, you know? So he's like making stuff, and he's making stuff for his own, but he sounds grounded in a way that Pressfield doesn't sound grounded here. You know what I mean? And I wonder is there a level of creative maturity that comes at a point at which you don't need to be manic to create? Does that make sense? Or you don't need to be miserable to create. And I'm not talking about the sitting down every day at the same time. I'm not talking about that. Just that it becomes something that doesn't need to be a battle all the time. It's just something you do because you enjoy doing it.
Yes, I do. Okay. I do think that, but I think Pressfield gets there a little at the end.
Okay.
You know, he wraps this thing up with, so I'm from the real world school in caps. But by real, I don't mean material reality. If art comes from pain, and it does, and this is according to him,
yep,
then the artist doesn't need street reality, blood reality, life reality. He can stay in his room like Proust and never come out. The pain that breeds great music or art needs no purchase in the real world. It's enough just to be born, just to be human, to really feel it. Angels don't produce art, neither do beasts. We do. You and I do, in response to the pain of being human without a credential and without the approval of anybody.
I tend to agree with all of that.
There's something there.
There is, but it also kind of reminds me of my most adolescent views of creativity.
Where you had to dress in black and live in a warehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's how it feels to me. And I don't necessarily think that he's always like this. That's why I say he sounded cranky this day. You know?
Maybe.
It sounds especially whatever.
Maybe it was taking in some of this story of the pianist, because I don't personally, I don't think that all creativity comes out of pain. I don't think that all art comes out of pain. I think it comes out of struggle, but that could be a struggle with materials. It could be a struggle with environment. It could be a struggle internally.
Yes. But that struggle does not necessarily need to be so monumental.
When you're young, it does.
Yeah. Maybe that's just me getting old. I just, you know, it's like after listening to a bunch of these things, and I listened to Tom Hanks, and I listened to, you know, Bobcat, and I've listened to Nathan Fillion and all these different, a bunch of different people. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting on that show because they actually take 2 hours to talk to somebody, which is good.
Right.
But you know, I will take those two. I listen to Tom Hanks and I listen to Bobcat like in the same day or 2 days in a row. Now, Tom Hanks is worth $400 million and works whenever he wants and whatever it is. Bobcat's making movies on handheld cameras in the woods because he enjoys making them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Do you think there's a qualitative difference between how much enjoyment one of those men gets than the other?
No.
Out of making movies?
And that is what I was kind of getting at, is that I've kind of come to this, not epiphany, not realization, but just sort of this, you know what? Just keep doing the thing that you like to do, whether or not you're getting paid for it. And other you don't know what will come of it, right? So just keep doing it. Like, if you do it because you enjoy doing it, because otherwise, you know, we all sit here and we talk about, oh, you know, I want to be a photographer because I love taking pictures. Right. But at the same time, then we get wrapped up in all this. Well, how am I going to make a living at? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that? And it's like, well, okay, all those things are true. But if you lose the, I like taking pictures and that's why I get enjoyment out of that, like the sort of the base level, tear everything else away. Why are you doing this? I do it because I like doing it. Well, then all the rest of that stuff is secondary. And the prime mover is just to sit down and paint, or sit down and write music, or sit down and play piano for this guy, or to write like Pressfield or Greg Bear or whoever else.
Right.
You know, or me. You know, like I was working on a screenplay last week, and I was working on this video thing, and I'm setting up a bunch of shoots that I'm doing at these restaurants in the area. And it's like, the only thing I can do is you know, sure, yeah, clients call me and I do shoots, whatever it is, but like, has the big one I'm waiting for come around? No? Okay, well, I can't force that to happen. The only thing I can do is keep making really good stuff that, so that, you know, eventually when the chance comes around, I'm really good at it and I can make the thing that I imagined versus the thing that I imagined and obsessed over but wasn't ready to make. So
are you becoming less concerned with legacy and more concerned with the present?
No, I'm becoming less concerned with how that legacy comes about. That legacy is only going to come about, and legacy loosely, legacy in my own mind, I guess, you know what I mean? That I spent my days on this earth well, kind of, you know, that's really what it comes down to. Now, the way I equate that is that I've made something that other people enjoy and might remember after I'm dead, you know, but ultimately it comes down to me feeling like I don't have any regrets about it, you know? And the only regret that I could currently have or imagine having right now as I sort of work through this is not have been making stuff when I could have been making stuff.
Right.
That's the ultimate regret. I didn't get a good enough gig this year, or I didn't get my thing on that magazine, or I didn't, what, who cares? You know what I mean?
Right.
Like right. That's all secondary. It's all, you know, you know? I don't know. It's just, so I read this and I agree with it in the sense that I would love to be that pianist guy, but I also realize, I step back and I go, that piano player guy is nuts.
Yeah. But for a year, at least in part, you were. For a year, you did 365,
yeah.
That's all you did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I could do that again. You know what I mean? In fact, I'm sort of ramping up to do stuff like to be that busy again, but that busyness, I don't think that my relationship with my partner, I don't think that, you know what I mean? I don't think I'm going to lose 35 pounds because I didn't have any food and I'm not going to be in a mental, like, I'm not going so far down the rabbit hole that I've lost sight of what it is that I'm trying to reach. And maybe that's right. Maybe that's the way that this guy is going. And maybe the question is, does he actually have to go there and be in a mental hospital in order to reach whatever he's trying to reach? Or is he just a little crazy? And if he backed off a little bit, he'd have a much happier life. You know?
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like, for him, happiness is where vision comes from. It sounds like
could be.
It's on the other side.
Yeah, it could be. You know, or, I mean, I don't know how old this guy is, but, you know, maybe I'm just a little older and a little further down the road than he is, you know? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I felt this way before. Right. I have idolized people like this. I still do in some ways, you know? I'll see people who are obsessive. You know, I can idolize Stanley Kubrick till the day's over, but I don't think Stanley Kubrick was sitting around idolizing other people. I think Stanley Kubrick was just a little crazy, and that's how he got on. You know, like, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think Stanley Kubrick was trying to become something else. I think he just was Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
And the only way for him to experience being Stanley Kubrick is just to be Stanley Kubrick and stop trying to be somebody else. I don't know. So, yes, I agree with this, although I think that he goes a little too heavy on the life is pain, princess, and
right.
Anybody tells you anything else is selling something.
Right,
you know,
right,
like,
right.
Okay, put it away, Pressfield. Like, not, you know, because if writing for him and creativity is all about pain and anger and whatever else he says here, you know, it's like the pain of just being born.
I don't think that it is, but I do think that it was.
For him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's an evolution there that I get from reading his stuff, that there is an evolution of that's where it started.
Yeah.
But to a lesser degree, that's not where I'm at now.
Right. In some ways I read this and I go, I understand what he's saying, but this feels like a phase that I've mentally moved past, or I'm trying to move past. Because I think you can get stuck in this stuff.
Sure you can.
You know, in a way that it's just like, I am not obsessive enough, and that's why I'm not getting anywhere. And you're not obsessing. You're not obsessing about the fact that you're doing the work. It's what was the thing I said the other day? That what's his name wasn't upset about when he wasn't working. He was obsessed about the fact that he wasn't working.
Right.
You know, and in some ways it's this
not
thing. It's
that
like
project XYZ wasn't getting done.
Yeah. He was obsessing about the fact that project XYZ, you know what I mean? Sort of a meta thing, like one step further down the road. And I feel like Pressfield in some ways like this. I have obsessed, and I'm just like, oh, I'm not as crazy as James Rhodes or whoever this guy is. And that's why I'm not rich and famous. It's like, well, there are a lot of well-adjusted creative people in the world. You know, I don't think Steven Spielberg is insane. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I don't think Steven Spielberg isn't eating because he can't finish the new movie.
Right. But you know? Quentin Tarantino might be.
Yeah, he might be. You know, maybe. But I think even Quentin Tarantino puts on, I'm sure he's really like that in real life, but I think when he's getting interviewed and stuff, he puts on a little bit more of the crazy juice because he knows that that's kind of what people want to see of him. You know what I mean?
Like maybe,
he's a showman too.
He did an interview not long ago with Gian Gomeshi, who I love. He does Q on CBC up in Canada.
Yep.
One of my favorite interviewers ever. And he was talking to Quentin about it was round about the time when oh my God, I'm just spacing on his last movie. Django Unchained came out.
Okay.
And he was talking about his writing process and how, you know, he asks him, does anybody ever say no to you?
Actors.
Yeah.
And what'd they say?
And Quentin was like, well,
not much anymore.
And he kind of stammered about it. And he's like, and Gian was like, so no, basically. And he's like, so do you approach writing that way that nobody's going to say no to you? Do you approach it that everything's going to be amazing? And he said, no, not at all. He said, when I finish a project, when I finish Django.
Come on, you could do a better impression than that.
Of what?
Of Quentin.
Of Quentin, no.
A little more manic.
Yeah, he's, yeah. Okay, so when I I can't do that.
Go ahead.
He's like, when I finish a project like Django and all the press is done and the DVDs are out and it's out of my head. It's, you know, people get to decide whether it sinks or swims.
Yep.
And I sit down to start something new. He said, it's just like it was with Reservoir Dogs. I'm there with a blank sheet of paper and a pen.
Yep.
And that's it.
Sure.
There that everything that I do has to stand on its own before it can be viewed in the totality of the body of work.
Yeah.
So for him, everything is starting at square one. Like he doesn't look at, oh, now that I've done this, I can just sit back and write another hit.
Yep. Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting. I think that there are creative people who look at it that way, where I went full circle, I'm right back at the starting line.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are other people who look at it as, I've built three rungs of this wall, now I'm going to build the next three rungs.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I think some of that comes down to, you know, I'll use Spielberg as the ancillary just because we were talking about him a second ago. I don't feel like Spielberg probably sees his career more as he's building something than Tarantino does. Because it's like, I'm going to try this new thing that's going to require, you know, even bigger budgets to pull off these special effects. And I'm going to do something that I've never done before, you know,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
I can only imagine doing that because I did this last thing that I'd never done before. You know what I mean? That like, I'm standing on the shoulders of what I've already done, as opposed to being right back down at ground level. And I don't think one's better, more valid than the other.
Right.
I just think that those are two different ways of looking at it. Maybe the similar to how Pressfield thinks that it's all about pain. And, you know, I was working on this interview with listener Todd Reynolds, friend of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And his thing where it's all about, for him, creating is all about joy. It's all about love. He's coming from the exact opposite angle. Now, maybe
of this Pressfield article.
Yeah.
Sure.
And maybe it's the same. Maybe it's the same thing as, you know, our old talk about trying to hit the center of the earth and coming at it from different angles. Maybe they're calling the same thing different things. You know, but I don't know. It's just it's interesting. But what all of these things have in common is that people are doing them. You know, Bobcat was saying that he used to go and he would be shooting one of his movies. And then he knew that 2 weeks later he'd have to go do some stand-up thing at a casino, which he doesn't really like doing, but he gets paid well, so he does them, right? That he would be sitting on set and he'd be like, oh, 2 weeks from now. Oh, no, it was, he told the story. He was at like some con or one of these film festivals, and like 4,000 people in the audience gave a standing ovation for the new film. And he's up on stage, you know, bowing and whatever it is, saying thank you or giving a little talk. He says, and he knows in the back of his mind that 2 weeks later he has to go to this casino to do this thing because the movie's not going to make him enough money to live on.
Right.
Right. And this is thousands of people at some big thing because, you know what I mean, whatever it is, right? He said, I used to think, oh, God, I have to go do that casino gig. He goes, now, he says, I've inverted it. And while I'm on stage at the casino thing doing my show, I'm thinking in the back of my mind, hey, that thing last week was pretty cool.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that was pretty great last week when all those people stood up for my movie. So that instead of the great thing being the baseline and everything else being less than, he appreciates the things that are great and realizes that his baseline is still pretty good.
Right.
You know? And it's a mental health thing for me, maybe, but like, I feel like that's a much healthier way of looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
No, I do too. I do too.
Yeah. I don't know.
I do love the bit, the bit of him in, One Crazy Summer where he got stuck in the Godzilla suit.
Did I ever tell you?
He like puts on the suit and he's like, thank you very much. It's great to be back here, Club Tokyo. You
know? Well, you know, my friend Jeremy Kyman, who been friends for 15 years, he was telling me a story of how he was at college and he was at a party. I mean, have I told the story on the show? He's at a party and this is like early, like 98. And IMDb had just started.
Okay.
And he's talking to some girl and, you know, a group of people. And this girl goes, yeah, I'm on IMDb. And he's like, what? What are you like? Did you like work on a movie or something? She goes, oh, when I was a kid, I was in this movie. And it was the girl from One Crazy Summer with the dogs.
No way.
Yeah.
It always had like the cone of shame on.
Yeah. She had only done like one movie in her life and it was like this movie that's like this cult hit.
Bosco!
And she was some college student at the time. You know what I mean? This was 15 years later, 10 years later. But it's just, I don't know. It's just funny to me how that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah,
but anyway,
she's the one who came out of the submarine at the end.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
you know,
funny.
Yeah, I'm going to put that, I'm going to put that episode on in the show notes too.
The Kevin.
Yeah. Pollock. He's a strange dude.
I saw him in LA once. I was having tires put on my car and it was at a Firestone dealer on like Highland, I think. Kevin Pollock came in there. He was getting tires on his girlfriend's BMW.
Okay.
And he was like on the phone the whole time, but it was really funny.
Like, was he being funny or was it just
funny?
Yeah,
he was just funny. Just like listening to him on the phone, just his mannerism. He was just hysterical.
Yeah.
You know, and I was sitting there giggling and he kept looking over at me.
It's fun at the show.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's good stuff. All right. What's next? We went deep.
What is next? Do you want to talk about this elephant in the room?
You know, okay. I read that.
Did you read this?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I went first last time. So you get to go first this time.
Okay. So this guy is a photographer / now educator / now book author / you know, feels right. Like / creative thinking guru.
Right. Dane Sanders wrote Fast Track Creative.
Okay. I don't know anything about his other work.
Okay.
So I've only read this. I don't know. It feels like he's trying to make a case for his new business model. Is what it sounds like to me, you know, like reading it, you know?
Okay. I guess the reason I added this is the idea that photography on some level has become more about just taking pictures.
Okay. Well, so the title of this thing is The Elephant in the Room, How the Death of Photography as We Know It Might Be the Best News Your Inner Creative Ever Had.
Right.
Heard, rather. Now, one of the things that he says here is just like, oh, it's, you know, dead for people who shoot weddings and events and whatever it is. The only photographers I know who are making good money are shooting weddings and events and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, interesting premise. But I get what he's saying in terms of there are more kids in the pool than there were 10 years ago.
Yep, there are.
And I added this to the notes before Paris Photo. Mm-hmm. And what I find an interesting contrast is when you are at a certain level, it does go back to just being about the photographs.
Yes. Yeah.
That you're not maintaining your Twitter feed and your Facebook presence. You're not even updating your website regularly.
Yeah.
You're just taking pictures.
You're just shooting. Yep. Yeah.
So
like, I don't get any more work because my website is up to date.
Right. Know? So right. I guess I wonder, is all of this social stream,
yeah,
is it a means to an end? Is it a growing pain to get to the next level?
For your average person, for a single right. person. Yes, and I think some people can sort of not jump it, but ignore it and still get somewhere.
I think it's valuable. I think for a great number of, let's keep it in the realm of photography, for a great number of photographers, their business lives or dies by their social media.
It's not the route.
Right. I think it's fantastic.
Yep.
But for people who are not social by nature, for people who are more introvert than extrovert, this is akin to, you know, having a finger cut off in the Yakuza. You know, it is pain. It is putting yourself out there as a personality is painful.
Right.
And
but not everyone can be a personality. This is not a growth market, right?
Right. But that's what I'm getting at is I think the premise or what I took away from this article is he's making the argument that you need to be a personality, that these other social skills are an imperative to surviving as a photographer. And while that might be true for some, I don't think it's as black and white as it's being made out in this piece.
That is precisely why I said it feels like it's an ad for his new business model. You know, he's just like, what does he say here? I've improved my skills at communication. I've improved my skills at writing. I've improved my skills at public speaking. Oh yeah. So now I'm a public speaker, author, whatever it is. So go buy my book. You know, like that's what it feels like. And it's like, okay, well, that's not necessarily true for everybody, guy.
I think it can work for some.
Then you're really no longer a photographer. You're an educator. In which case, then you're an educator, but don't. Like then for somebody who wants to be a photographer, they don't want to be an educator necessarily, you know?
And, getting back to what I said, for some, that may be painful to think about that.
Yep. Sure.
You know, the idea of self-promotion is borderline impossible.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Or just daunting. Not even that it's not an effort thing. It's sort of a, if you don't get in and say the things that people want to hear, you're not going to get there anyway. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. You never get past the gatekeeper.
Right. The difference between your site and some site that's got 5 million daily views because all they talk about is gear. You know what I mean? Like there's a difference between those things, but you're not about to start.
Thanks for opening up that wound.
Well, no, I'm sorry. But you know what I'm saying? Like, but no, like Faded and Blurred is a great site and better than those sites in many ways. But if what people want is, you know, something that you don't want to give them because that's not what you're trying to do.
Right.
Well, there's no way you're going to equate those two things. They're completely different, you know?
Sure.
I also feel like, and maybe this is just my weird mind thing, but I feel like there were a few years there where everyone wanted to be a professional photographer and they were everywhere. Like just like this multiplication of competition.
Mm-hmm.
I almost feel like in the last year or so, a lot of those people went away or have started to realize that, oh, I'm not going to be able to make it as a professional photographer. So I'm going to go back and do that on the side and keep doing XYZ.
Because it takes work.
Absolutely.
It takes vision. It takes diligence. It takes craft. It takes learning. It takes standing on the shoulders of people that came before you.
And you know what? Like I was even thinking, it's like there are a lot of people who can take most of the magazines I take for pictures. Nice dyslexic Bill.
Yeah.
Most of the pictures I take for magazines are not particularly like, I'm not like, oh, put this on a billboard. This is like the growth of my, you know, the best thing I've ever done. But you know what? A magazine calls me and they say, we need a picture of so-and-so by next Friday. And they hang up the phone or send me an email and they know that I'll call the guy, set up the thing, do the shoot, get him the stuff 2 days before they need it. And they know that's going to happen. And that's why they call me. Right. So it's like taking the pictures is only part of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's other layers of what it means to be a professional which are above and beyond knowing how to take the pictures. Now, I'm not saying there are other people who can't do that. Of course there are, but there's a lot of people who can't, you know what I mean? Where those, that level of the business, quote unquote, is difficult for them, or mm-hmm. they're uninterested in it, or they're just a little flaky, or they're too artsy and not, they can't get the job done. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so like I was saying, I think that in some ways there are less people trying to be a professional photographer, and it's actually eased a little bit, almost like that hump is gone. We're over the top of the hill and it's coming back down a little bit, you know, sort of like the bubble burst a little bit, mm-hmm. Which is a good thing for those of us who are actually trying to make a living doing it. 'Cause it's not so crazy, you know, it isn't every guy and his cousin as much. It's like, you know, every other cousin.
Okay.
Or some, I don't know, in some weird way, if it feels that way. Now, I have no numbers to support right. this, but I think there's a lot more people who said or are saying, you know what? I enjoy doing this. I'm just going to do this as a hobby. You know,
which there is nothing wrong with.
Absolutely not. It's just a different thing. And I think that actually in many ways that's better for photography. You know, mm-hmm. And I think that it takes a little bit of the air out of this guy's article saying that basically setting it up to say, you can't make a living as a photographer. Well, I know a lot of photographers who are making a living, dude. So, right. you know, why don't you speak for yourself? You know, I don't know. It's interesting. So, yeah, I don't know. I think you and I have a similar view on that whole thing.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't have.
I mean, similar view on this article is what I'm
on this about. Article. Yeah. I don't have the sort of firsthand accountability that you do as
to make your living
a photographer. Yeah. Right. I don't have that. I'm on the periphery.
Yeah, I'm at the meetup yesterday, and yeah, I was there on a Monday afternoon, but I was also booking a gig on my email while I was sitting there drinking a seltzer, you know? So there's that whole thing too. Hey, is it true that Google Plus is dead? Is that a rumor?
Depends on who you talk to. The guy that started it and
Vic Gundotra.
Has been running it. Gone, left the company, and apparently a lot of the people that have been working on it have been reassigned to Android and mobile and things like that. But if you talk to other people, they say that he wasn't really liked, and they're glad that most of the employees are glad that he's gone. What that means, I don't know.
That's very frustrating.
Look, Google, no matter what they do and how much money they throw at it, I don't think Google Plus is ever going to match either the numbers or the reach of
Facebook. No, but at the same time, there are a lot of conversations going, a lot more conversations that go deeper on Google Plus than they go on Twitter or Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, I think Google Plus, a couple of things that are working against Google Plus. One, the interface. Yes, it's clean, but it's still clunky.
I don't think Facebook is any better.
Well, I'm not. Okay. But
I'm just saying competition wise. I'm just saying.
I don't care about the competition. That's like saying, you know,
you're comparing it to what then?
I'm not comparing it to anything. I'm saying as a standalone site, the functionality is anemic in areas.
Okay.
The photo functionality feels tacked on. The fact that they required you to have a G+ account because you had a Gmail account, and then required you to have a G+ account to comment on YouTube, and you know, all of these sort of little infrastructure things that were done to inaccurately bolster numbers just feels like a land grab.
Okay, but isn't there a case to be made that you know, the YouTube is better off if the comments are somewhere where other people could see them other than YouTube and whatnot? You know what I mean? Isn't there a case to be made that's actually a good thing?
Maybe, but yeah. Why force it on people? People don't like having things forced upon
them.
It's
true. I don't know. All I know is that I know a lot of people who talk about like the auto upload and auto awesome and all these things that Google Plus does for images, which they've gotten great marks on from all the people in the tech industry saying, wow, this is really good functionality. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think it's sad if it's true that they are sort of deprecating it or, you know, whatever.
I think it could be something even more compelling than it is.
Yes.
With some changes, with some functionality changes.
It could certainly be better. The question
it's kind of like Flickr. You know, people are saying how great Flickr is now, and it's got a fresh coat of paint and overhaul and blah, blah, blah.
Is it actually? I don't know. I never used
Flickr. It looks great on the front end, but the back end still looks like it's 1997.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You still can't delete a group that you moderate or that you own. You still have to delete or remove users one at a time and then simply leave the group. You can't remove it. So all of this sort of back-end admin work still feels very clunky despite the slick new, you know, aluminum siding that they've put on it.
Right, right. Yeah. I don't know. So if let's just play devil's advocate or play the nightmare scenario for a second. Let's say they get rid of Google Plus.
I don't think they'll get rid of it.
Do you think they're just going to let it sit there as is?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on, like I said, it depends
maybe
on
the new
read.
Guy coming in will give some new blood and say, this is what we need to do to make this better.
Maybe. But at the moment, they've moved a lot of the Google Plus dev team onto other projects.
Yeah. It's funny. If I go to Google Plus, and I don't have that many people in circles, you know, I mean, I have the group and then, you know, maybe 50 or 80 people in circles that I see their stuff. I don't feel nearly as guilty going to Google Plus as I do going to Facebook. Feels like a big empty mess of terrible links to me when I go there now, you know, or things about people on ancillary tendrils of my life telling me things about their new baby or their kids, you know, kindergarten party or whatever. Like, I'm like, I don't need this information, you know, where I go to Google Plus and I was like, oh, look, that's a pretty good picture. And oh, hey, there's this article by, you know, whoever, some guy. And I find it much more target rich than I do Facebook. Facebook to me is just like this. It's like a high school cafeteria. That's what it feels like.
Well, yeah. And I think that's very sort of discipline or area of interest specific.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, the average person is not going to Google Google Plus, but maybe that's actually the strength of Google Plus.
Yeah. I mean, again, I like the community of it. I just don't like the design. I don't like some of the functionality. There were some strange choices being made.
Okay, that's fair. What else we got here?
You put something in. Wait, here, let's move this. You want to talk about this Andrew Wyeth thing?
Yeah, did you see this?
Yeah.
All right, so Wyeth the painter is from, I think it's Michigan. So if you guys probably know the painting Christina's World, I guess is what it's called. Which is at MoMA. So next time you come to New York, Jeffrey, we'll go see it. The Washington Post had a photo essay in which they show all these pictures from his house and his area where he painted that sort of give you an idea of what he was seeing while he was painting and how those things sort of informed each other.
And it's fascinating.
I think it's amazing.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny
I
that
I swipe this and put it up on Faded and Blurred.
I'll put in the show notes for everyone who hasn't seen it here. Let me just do that right now. And what's cool about it is that even like that second picture is of just, you know, this road going up to a barn with the trees and whatever it is.
Right.
And the overcast thing, like this is sort of what it looked like where I grew up. Like my house and stuff didn't look like this, but there were places near me that looked like this, you know, older houses, whatever it is. So like,
it's really neat.
I look at this and this reminds me of my childhood in the sense that this is what things were like around me when I was a kid. And you sort of, so you look at it and then you look at some of his paintings and you go, oh yeah, that's why he sees it that way, you know?
Right.
And
right.
I think that Michigan and say the Northeast has that sort of feel to it. One of my favorite sections of this whole thing is the tub. Let's see, where is it? It's like a photo 12 and 13.
The one with the buckets on the wall?
Yeah. So it's that one. And then the next one is the painting he made of that spot.
Right, right.
And it's just really cool seeing the sort of before and after, you know, what a photographer would see here versus what he saw there as a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating to me. And, you know, obviously a little bit outside of the realm of photography, but at the same time, telling, you know, it's like Eggleston, we were talking about earlier, Eggleston's from Mississippi or wherever he lives, or Memphis. You know, so his pictures, his whole thing feels very sort of central southeastern U.S. to me. Because that's what he was looking at when he made it.
You know? This is Pennsylvania.
Oh, is that what it is? Okay. I was going to say, I thought it was Michigan, but Pennsylvania.
Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania.
That makes much more sense. You know what I'm saying, though?
Yeah, absolutely.
It has that look, that feel to it. And I think that certain places, just like, you know, people who are photographers and live, you know, where you are taking pictures, where you are, or LA, those pictures feel very, very different than, you know, the pictures that I take. Yeah, it's not far from, it's between Wilmington and Philadelphia, Chad's Ford.
I love this quote. There was a devilish playfulness about him, according to Nancy Hoving, wife of Thomas Hoving, the late director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. He liked to have secrets, Hoving recalls, so he could reveal them. I love that.
Yeah, it's a good quote. Yeah. Anyway, just I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, good find.
Something very, very different than our normal stuff. So yeah, Wyeth. I'll put the link in the show notes. Christina's World is one of Conrad's favorite paintings, and she always thought it looked like Dorothy getting dropped off the tornado.
Ah, okay, sure. I could see that.
When in reality, I may be getting this wrong. Maybe this is the apocryphal story, but like that it's actually about some neighbor of his or something who couldn't use her legs. And he saw her like dragging herself through the field one day or some kind of crazy thing like that. So it's funny how like what somebody imagines it is and what it really is, or, you know, even maybe that's a story too. And it's something else, just changes everything around. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You like this, you like these, Oleg, yeah,
what do you think of these
photos?
I think they're interesting. They're beautiful. Yeah. And
you know, the camera that he's using, though, is sort of a knockoff Hasselblad.
One of them.
Kiev, yeah.
The Kiev 88 looks like a...
Yeah, they're very cool. And you know what it is? What makes them cool, though, is not the fact that he's using a $50 camera. It's these crazy fields and trees and stuff that he gets to work on. They're just crazy. Right. I wonder where the heck these places
are. And he's
are.
Building... like full size props. Like yes. There's a girl standing in a field with a book of matches and the matches are, you know, 4 feet long or something.
Yeah. Or the giant suitcases.
Right.
Down
right.
The bottom.
It's very much like, Storm Thurgeson.
Is that the one who makes the crazy headdresses for the women?
No. Storm Thurgeson is the guy who shot, all of Pink Floyd's stuff.
Okay. Yeah.
You're thinking of Kirsty Mitchell.
There you go. Yeah, but that feels the same way, like that crazy headdress of all the flowers.
Yeah.
You know? Like, yeah, it's a beautiful photo. It's a beautiful photo because you have a beautiful girl in this crazy headdress of flowers, you know? It's not technically any sort of special photo. It's just a gorgeous photo.
It's vision, man, yep, and he's got
vision.
It.
It's vision. It's true.
Yeah,
I like the fake matchbook, the giant matchbook.
Yeah, that one's really cool. So he says he uses a Kiev 6C and a Kiev 88 with 90mm 2.8 and 180mm 2.8 lenses. And a 300-4.0.
He likes to shoot long.
Favorite lens of all time is a 300mm 4.0 by Meyer Optik Oristegor.
That's a long lens. I'm gonna
on
buy
medium
really
format.
Long. Yeah, but even on medium format, that's, what is it? How much is it? 300?
300.
So it's like a 200, you know what I mean? It's not. It's not that short. It's still pretty long.
Yeah, I love this stuff, though. So take a look at it.
Yeah, those are really, really good.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
We find some good stuff. You find some good stuff. Where'd you find this one?
Somebody sent it to me. I don't remember who sent it to me.
People send you all kinds of stuff, don't they?
Yeah. I don't remember where I found it.
Oh, hey. This morning, quick little aside.
Yep.
Fielding was in town. You know, we went into the Leica store.
Did you buy something to return?
And I was playing with the S2 for a minute in there.
Hey, I got you a keychain, by the way, a Leica keychain.
I saw that. Well, I'll be excited to actually see it eventually when you bring it to me.
I'm going to send it to you.
Oh, you're going to send it to me.
Go ahead.
But anyway, I got to play with that S2, the big medium formatty one.
Oh yeah.
Which everyone says is, you know, like butter. It was nice. It felt big and chunky, and it felt good in the hands. It didn't, it like some people say, oh, when you pick it up, it's a photographer's camera and that kind of stuff. I didn't feel it was especially like amazing. You know, viewfinder was nice. It was kind of slow, like the way that the you know, it's an SLR, so it's got a mirror and the whole thing. The mirror box, the taking picture, the blackout was a long time, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the images were amazing, and I'm not taking anything away from those. But I didn't pick it up and go, oh God, I need this. You know, I was like, oh, yeah, it's pretty nice. $22,000? Yeah, no thanks.
Did they have the new T there?
That's the new little tiny one.
The new smaller little one. Aluminum one?
Yeah. If they did, I wasn't looking at it.
They had it at the show at Paris Photo.
What is the point? It's just a mirrorless Leica.
Yeah, it's a, what is it? Is
well,
it
they're all mirrorless. So
18 megapixel?
24? Yeah, but it's a smaller.
I don't know. It just, it's not very comfortable. And it's all like it's milled out of a single block of aluminum type thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you hold it longer than 5 minutes, inevitably your hand starts to get, you know, sweaty. So you're constantly like wiping off your hands or I don't know.
Jeffrey, I sent you a link. Go look at this link I just sent you and look at the way the guy is holding this camera and tell me that looks really comfortable. It's some review for USA Today of the Leica T, and the guy couldn't look less comfortable holding the camera.
Yeah.
He's got one hand holding it and the other hand like bracing the first hand.
It's not a comfortable camera to own.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, can you get into a Leica for $3,000 now? Yeah, sure. I think the body is 18.
If you buy something, I don't know. What does it say?
I think it's 1800 for the body.
Yeah. But you'd be better off buying a used M9 or an M8. You know, like I would rather have that than some new Leica mount that who knows how long it's going to be around, you know?
Yeah, it's, look, it's a lifestyle thing, right?
Yeah, this is totally a lifestyle. You know, I was actually showing Fieldy so there's an M7 and next to it was an MP. Now the MP is sort of like the no markings, no Leica red thing on the front, you know, like engraved top. You know, that most people tape over. It's sort of like, if what you want is a Leica to use, you buy that one. If you want a Leica so people will see you using a Leica, you buy that one. You know, it's like they're sitting right next to each other, and one, you wouldn't know what it was unless you knew what it was. And the other one had like Leica M7, you know, like engraved all over it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this was, you know, is it nice looking? Is it well designed? Sure, I guess, but it's not very comfortable.
You could buy a Fuji for less money, you know.
Right.
Or anything
Rinzi else. Was using that Fuji X-T1, and I got a chance to look through the viewfinder, and it is gorgeous.
As good as looking through an optical viewfinder?
For you, no. For me, yes.
Okay. And you don't like the EVF on your camera is not enough.
I think it's fine.
You think it's fine?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, then, that's where we'll differ. Although it was funny yesterday at the little get together, I had an M7 with me, and I asked Millie to take a picture of us, like me and Freddie, or me and Fielding, or somebody. And she used to shoot Leicas, and she picked it up and she goes, oh. She was like, oh, you know, like she was like, the memories, you know, the weight, the heft, you know, it's just
nice.
It's just a completely different way of looking at it. Hey, I put this in the show notes. Just it's somewhat photography related, but kind of cool. Did you see this Warhol thing? Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of it reminds me of did you ever see Hockney? The video of Hockney using the original Quantel paint box?
I have seen that. Yes.
Yeah. That's what this feels like to me.
You like it, just as an aside, you like Hockney's paintings?
Yes.
Okay. All right. You'll have to explain to me someday what makes them special.
I don't know that they're special. I just sometimes like things and I don't know really why. I look at them
and I go, I don't get why this is important, but maybe I'm missing something. Maybe I got to talk to some people. Anyway, so apparently Warhol got an Amiga in 1985.
Right.
And he had a tablet and he messed around with a few things. It doesn't seem like he used it all that extensively. He just probably messed around with it for an hour. And he saved, you know, some images. And those images ended up on these discs and the computer and the whole thing ended up at the Warhol Museum, but no one had touched it in X years, you know. And apparently they got these discs and they were just like, oh, I wonder what's on these. And they tried to figure it out. Unfortunately, they were in a format that no longer exists.
Of course.
Right. So they had the discs, but they didn't have the format. You know, they didn't know how to do it. Right. So they ended up bringing in this guy, and I found, you know, this is the wrong article. I'm going to find a better one. They basically use this open source tool, Jeffrey, that can pull off all the data off a disk, not the data, but sort of the pulse widths and stuff.
Oh, wow.
So it like basically is like a raw rip of a cassette, you know, or of a disk,
right?
A floppy. And then it could use that to reconstruct the file system based upon those bips and bops.
Wow.
And then they had to reconstruct the file format of the images, because ultimately the image data is, you know, in some sort of, here's a chunk that is the location, here's the chunk that is the color,
right,
here's the chunk,
right.
You know, it's, you know, so they had to basically recreate it and extract it out. And they got, you know, a Campbell soup can and some playing with The Birth of Venus and whatever. And I just thought that that was just a really crazy thing, that things that we make now, you know, the old adage of, oh, you make sure you keep updating your stuff because it'll be gone if you don't.
Right.
I was talking to Claude the other day, and I went on a walk, and he was telling me that, you know, in the movie industry, people don't archive on hard drives. You know, they either archive onto film, you know, back onto acetate,
right,
or they archive to tape, you know, basically like data tapes.
Right, right, right.
And there's this one format, which I can never remember what the stupid name of it is. Here, I can look it up right here. LTO. It's called LTO tapes.
Okay.
And I think they hold like a gig and a half of tape or some crazy thing like that, or a terabyte and a half or something like that. And they back up all their footage to these tapes, but these drives cost like $1,700 and they are only SCSI and SAS connections, you know.
They're like zip disks.
Essentially, yeah. But apparently, you know, the problem is that the hard drives, if you don't spin them up every once in a while, they say that the motors stop working or whatever it is. And I wonder if that's still true of modern drives, considering the tolerances and the quality of, you know, modern mass-produced drives.
Well, what were the big, like, the big tape backups that...
Yeah, like the SciQuest. No, the
SciQuest. That's what it
like
was.
Like all those things. And you think, really, no one's come up with a better solution for this format. Because who the hell is going to know who's going to have one of these tape machines
right
in four, you know, 40 years? Like I always have, I mean, I have hard drives in my closet that are like parallel ATA. You know what I mean? Like some old drive from some old
right,
computer.
Right, right, right.
And long ago, that 180 gig drive, I either turned it into a disk image or pulled everything I needed off of it with some kludged together thing to plug into my computer, because I know pretty soon I'm not going to be able to get to them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this is just an example of people who had the wherewithal to go get the stuff from the Warhol. And it's a really cool story. I'm going to find the better link and I'll put in the show notes for the tech nerds among you.
You need to explain to me. We'll have a Hockney Warhol meeting.
Oh, what's so great about Warhol?
Yeah. Because I've never understood his allure.
You know what it is? I don't like Warhol's work that everyone knows, right? I think that the interesting thing about Warhol is not his work, but the conversations he started by saying, I'm going to have a factory of people who are creating art. Is it still my art if a factory create? You know what I mean? Like that sort of, those sort of questions. If it's mass produced, is it still art? Blah, 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 blah. I think those questions are interesting. I do not think that Andy Warhol's art is interesting.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, we agree on that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. I think they liked him because he was experience. You know what I mean? Like people wanted him around because he had the crazy hair. You ever see his like early illustration stuff? He was a commercial illustrator before he became a fine artist.
Mm-mm.
And he was really good. There was like an American Masters or one of those, you know, PBS shows all about Warhol that you should find and watch, because it's fascinating, because they talk about him like moving to New York, and he was like, he ended up living with his mother at some point or some crazy thing. Like she was living upstairs, but he was like he was an artist, a commercial artist, like a draftsman, a really good one. And then he just started doing the crazier stuff. Yeah. So, you know, people can change, I guess. I don't know, you know. Anything else you want to say before we get to our photographer of the week? Jabberwocky.
I'd like a sandwich.
Would you like a sandwich?
Yes.
Hey, Alan.
I'd like a sandwich.
What if somebody sends it to you? No, FedExes you a sandwich.
Send me a sandwich?
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, I'm getting a... speaking of FedEx,
yeah.
I'm getting a new iPad.
How many have you gone through now? You make fun of me. How many have you gone through?
Okay, well, the one I had, the home button didn't work. So I said, I brought it to the Apple store, and they said, no, you gotta go back to Apple. Because I bought a refurbished one.
Well, right? That's why you don't buy refurbished ones. But go ahead.
Ugh. Anyway, so home button didn't work.
Yeah.
So I called them, and I said, okay, home button doesn't work. And they said, well, what you have to do is you've got to buy another one and then return this one. We don't, you know, if you don't want to have any sort of overlap. Or you can wait for this one to get sent back. And
I would wait.
No. I just ordered another one. But they said, what we can do is we can expedite the shipping.
Okay.
And I said, okay, so what does that mean? And basically what it means is it shipped yesterday and it will be here Thursday.
From where?
China.
Oh, yeah. I've had two or 3 day shipping from Shenzhen to my mother's house in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's
unbelievable.
And they said it could even be here tomorrow. But tomorrow or Thursday at 10:30 a.m. at the latest.
Hey, at least you live on the East Coast or the West Coast.
But I'm just thinking to myself, how insane is that? What, like, to go from China to my door in 2 days?
Yeah. Yeah. Not only that, but it's not like it's some guy who gets on the it's not like some guy got on an airplane. It is some giant container got on an airplane and then was distributed from the other side.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It's insane.
It's crazy.
Yeah. Anyway, all that to say, I really like who you chose for Photographer of the Week.
You like that one?
Yeah.
Actually, I think this is somebody who, I think somebody sent this in to us. Somebody recommended it. In fact, I'm going to look it up right now.
The guy who shot Nevermind called and wants his photo back.
Jay Scott wrote this in. I don't know.
This is good. Person.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Art Kane.
Now, a lot of people know a number of his photographs.
Yes. Like I didn't know the name, but I knew the one of the Who, that sort of iconic image of them draped in the British flag.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's a great shot.
Yeah. It's yeah, the British flag one and the classic one of all of the jazzers on the front stoop of that,
yep,
of that building in Harlem that, you know, it's like that picture is actually the basis of that, the movie, The Terminal.
Hmm.
You ever watch that movie?
The Tom Hanks one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, there's all kinds of crazy rock and roll ones, the picture of Dylan, all kinds of crazy stuff here. Lots of pictures of Dylan.
The Rolling Stones shot looking up. There's some great stuff of Aretha Franklin.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Look, Cream sitting on some railroad tracks. No railroad tracks. Don't use railroad tracks.
You're saying no one should, or no one should now?
No one should now.
Yeah.
They're done. They're over. They're played out. Stop using them.
Yeah.
I'm talking to you, senior shooters. Stop using railroad tracks.
What do people do? Oh, you mean, those people. Yeah. I thought you meant I thought you meant the seniors themselves taking pictures shouldn't be doing it. You're saying the people taking pictures of the seniors shouldn't be doing it.
My roommates?
Yeah. I love
it. Boy, there's some great stuff.
If you look up Art Kane on Google, here, wait, I'm going to send you a picture just because I love this picture. Look how cool this picture is. Nice wide angle, but like,
oh wow, great stuff.
You know, it's good.
So what do we know about him? What give me some of the info.
You want some numbers?
Give me some of the, like, when was this guy?
He
looks like he's got to be, you know, he's got to be dead by now, right?
1925 to 1995. So yes,
okay.
He's dead.
Okay.
He died 20 years ago.
You like the dead photographers?
I don't. I was looking at this guy's stuff and I was like, wow, this is really, really great. He committed suicide at age 69.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like, okay, unless maybe he was sick.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that. But you kind of think, you're 69, man. Like, you've kind of gone through most of the pain that you're going to go through before.
It's like getting a divorce after 60 years.
Yeah,
write
it's
out.
Like, what is the point? Just write it out. born Arthur Kanofsky, New York City. Fashion and music photographer. This is from his Wikipedia entry. 1950s through early 1990s. Shot Bob Dylan, Sonny and Cher, Aretha Franklin, Zappa, Morrison, Joplin, Rolling Stones, The Who. In World War II, he served an unusual unit called the Ghost Army, an incubator for many young artists. He became, at 26 years old, the art director of 17 Magazine, one of the youngest art directors of a major publication. And he began to explore his passion for photography, studied under Alexei Brodovich, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Alexei Brodovich, who was largely responsible for Avedon.
Yep. In 1958, he got an assignment that would launch his career as a photographer when he assembled 57 legendary jazz musicians for Esquire magazine in Harlem. And so there's a documentary, A Great Day in Harlem, which I've never seen and always wanted to see, about that photograph.
This blue stockings photo from 1962. Fantastic.
Yeah. Good stuff, right? I choose good.
Yeah. Yeah, this is great. Oh, the Harlem stuff is fantastic.
I like seeing photographers like him who are not known to everybody, but are doing things that looking at this stuff, that because it's like this stuff still looks and feels fresh to me, even though it's 50 years old.
These Harlem shots, 1958. These are genius.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you get all those dudes in one place at one time? I wonder how hard that was. That must have been hard.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's interesting
about that, though? If let's say you were trying to get together, I don't know. Let's say, what would the equivalent be? That was 1958. Okay. So that wasn't even like too far gone. Let's say you were trying to get all of the Lower East Side punk people who were still alive in front of where CBGBs used to be for some photo shoot nowadays. How different that would be now than it was probably in 1958. Just because the amount of times that those people had gotten their photos taken and were in the press. And you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That nowadays we're so inundated with photographs of everybody, and everyone who's famous has had their picture taken so many times that it's more and more difficult to make any one particular photograph of someone special.
Why are there no books of this guy's work?
There are none.
There's a poster on Amazon. There's one book called Paper Dolls, published October 1984. What is going on?
Yeah. So something going on.
There needs to be...
You know, it's a great photo. You see the one of the boxer lying down in the ring?
Yeah, where it's upside down. Ugh, yeah. Great shot.
It's amazing.
Yeah, this is nuts.
Yeah, he liked the upside down thing.
Licensing. Okay. Syndication and licensing. Mythco1@verizon.net. That doesn't sound shady at all.
Wait, that's what his website says?
On the actual web, on arcane.com.
Yeah, because his website is not really up to snuff.
Looks like it hasn't been updated since 2008.
Yeah, definitely not since people stopped using Flash for websites. See what I did there? You love
loading.
That.
Loading.
Yeah.
Loading.
Like 1, 0%, 0%, 10%, 40%.
No, what you need is an intro movie, man. You need an intro movie.
Sometimes I see people who still have those or want them for a new thing, and I'm like, no.
No, you don't.
You know, it's great. You go to editorial on his website and look at We the People, the first one.
Yeah, it's a great shot.
Oh, it's amazing.
1961. Amazing. Think about that.
Yeah.
Still looks like a just a fresh concept.
You could still walk.
Well,
It does. It does. No, you're right. It looks like a fresh concept, right? And the one of Venice looking like it's sinking from 1969.
Mm-hmm,
this guy is a monster.
Yeah, this is really great stuff. Really, really terrific work.
Yeah, this guy's kind of pissing me off a little bit. But that's that's good.
You know what? I'm going to write to these guys and see what's what.
Verizon.net, huh?
Yeah.
Have fun with that.
Yeah.
You sure they don't have a backup AOL account?
I wonder if it'll go to his flip phone.
We're so awful. God, I hope they don't listen to this or you're never going to get
permission.
Person
who does licensing. Kidding.
No, but there's an opportunity. Definitely an opportunity for a book. Amazing stuff.
I mean, this is fantastic work.
Yeah.
All right.
Anybody, anything else you want to say before we
anybody
wrap
else
this up?
You want to say?
Anybody else you want to piss off?
Yeah. Usually that's you. So, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to mix it up here.
I apologize. Podcast at ontakingpictures.com if you want to get a hold of either one of us. And said it at the top of the show. I'm going to say it again. Please, please, please tweet the show, Facebook the show, email somebody about the show.
Yeah.
Spread hashtag the grow the show.
Yeah.
See what I did there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you need if you need any press quotes, talk to Jeffrey.
Yeah, there you go. Bill tweets at Bill Wadman.
I do.
I tweet at Jeffrey Sidoris.
Yep.
Faded and Blurred, you can find some cool stuff there. Have you written anything, or did you get too much flack
last
over
and then
the
I got working on some other stuff? I got some good feedback on that one, actually. Well, one guy made a nasty comment, and then the other people made very staid comments. He always
turns
you know
out,
what
Ansel Adams didn't like it.
Yeah, I know. Jeffrey, don't feed the trolls. yeah, I'm gonna write some more. But I've actually been working on some other stuff, so I've kind of been busy. But okay.
I will try and get a post about book paper and binding and things like that up today or tomorrow.
Yep.
Please leave feedback on that, whether you think that sounds interesting. And good.
Okay. We will talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. Have a great tomorrow. Wait, are we doing another show tomorrow?
Oh, no. Next week. Sorry, these weeks go by so quickly, it feels like tomorrow.
are we doing two a week now?
Sure. Yes? If I say yes, does that make it means it has to happen?
No.
All right. We'll see you next week.
All right. Thanks for listening, everyone.
All right, bye. Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain. Something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say, though I know your words will lay me out. So I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way